is calling in the bonds of love we meet for the world anew.
Welcome to Muffin Talk. Jodah and welcome to Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is a weekly radio program to which I invite guests to talk about their work and their passion for issues on community programs, social justice, interfaith relations, Bible studies, or the Catholic Church. Today, my guest is Professor Thomas O'Loughlin, who is joining us from the United Kingdom. Tom, you have been in our radio program several times. You are an emeritus professor of historical theology, and I think that we'll write a little bit more about your background in on the website, because I would like to take all the time that we have to spend talking to you about the church history, the historic theology, and also the size of the churches. I listened to one of your interviews in the University of Nottingham video clips that you were showing a little lamp from Northern Africa, and you explained how this little lamp would have been used by early Christians who were sharing the light from oil lamps, a lamp to celebrate the creation. In the beginning, let there be light. This fits very well to our current series on Genesis and the creation stories. However, you also connected this little lamp to early Christian communities. Can you tell us more about how big typical early Christian communities were, and what do you know about them?
One of the interesting things about early Christian communities is that they, when we use the word church, it meant a collection of people. It was a bit like the word football team. It means people, whereas we have another word for football stadium, where you play football. We tend to think of the word church, there's a church down on the end of the corner. And we don't think of it as a collection of people. What we have to think of in the early churches is that we have small communities of people. And if you think about a large dining room in a wealthy Christian's home, that would have been the largest gathering that the Christians had. And that was not only for practical reasons. They didn't yet own property. They didn't yet have an official presence in the society. But it also fitted the fact that before a very recent time, most people lived their lives very close to home. Until the 19th century, the majority of human beings never traveled more than 7 miles from the place they were born. It would be different if you were a trader or a soldier or a shepherd, or if you were some sort of official, like a priest or a tax collector or something. But most people, they live in a much smaller area. And the way we know it's 7 miles, because that's as far as you can go and come back in a day. So we think of people coming from miles around to a church. But if you actually have to look after farm animals, milk cows, you have to get fires going, you actually need your church building very close to you. Now, in New Zealand, all the churches were built after the transport revolution. So in New Zealand, churches are by nature, just the way it is, they're spread out, often many miles apart. But think of a European city. A European city would be no bigger than what we would call a large town. Yes, it would have its cathedral, big, probably still a great tourist attraction. But in that city, there would be many, many small churches, because people went to their local grouping, or else they went to a special grouping. So, for instance, all the people who were involved with a particular industry, the carpenters, in a medieval city would have a church they went to, and they went to as their guild church. But equally, if you were a housewife, you went to the small local church. So we have to think of our modern big buildings as a completely new phenomenon. In the early church, it was effectively someone's dining room. And we know from the average size of dining rooms in Corinth, where they've been excavated, and this is corroborated by excavations in parts of the ruins of Ephesus, that if you could get 30 or 40 people into the room, you would be squeezing them in. So we have to think of an early church as a community of about 30 or 40 people. And given how low is the productivity of land, that's effectively the group that can be supported. That's the village that can be supported. Again, drive in any rural part of Europe and you will see the big churches built in the 19th century, but then you see all the tiny churches. And the curious thing is the early churches not only felt that was as big as they could manage for practical reasons and for transportation reasons, but they also felt that that was as large as you could have, since the nature of our liturgy is not the temple liturgy, but the liturgy built around a meal. Luke tells us that the apostles continued worshipping in the temple and breaking bread in their houses. Because our liturgy, the central act of our liturgy, is not worshipping an object in a place. It's gathering around a table and then engaging in that table fellowship to offer worship. So the dining rooms of Corinth and Ephesus were not only big enough or as big as they needed, the logistics and population argument, but they were also appropriate. And then when the Christians began building specialized church buildings, two things are happening. On the one hand, the liturgy is becoming ever more remote. The liturgy is taking on a sacral character because it's miming pagan Roman worship, which is a very particular type of temple cult.
Was it called liturgy at that time?
Oh, Christians have always referred to their worship as their liturgia. Their liturgia means our common work, our public work. So in other words, it's not the prayers we say in private, it's not our family prayers, it's our work as a public group. Liturgy is very well translated in the name of the new Anglican liturgical prayer book called Common Worship. So they gathered for common worship, and on the one hand, they wanted to make it something that was done by an expert on their behalf. So we get the beginnings of a clerically dominant liturgy. And the survival of that into our own times in memory are the altar rails. The area where the cleric is railed off. And curiously, you see that also in the fact that as the language has moved from Latin into either the Romance languages or into the Germanic or Celtic languages, language became the specialist knowledge of the cleric. So on the one hand, you have liturgy changing from being a communal meal to be ever more, in inverted commas, sacral, because it's taking on the flavor and dynamics of pagan Roman worship. But at the same time, there is still the need to have a place to worship that is logistically close to the people. So the new churches they start building are actually not much larger than dining rooms. And of course, these were facilitated because most of these churches were not served by any of the highly skilled clergy that might become one day bishops. They were served by local clergy who, where it was the task of being the cleric and looking after the cleric's bit of land, moved from father to son. And that's why we get all the families in Europe called with names like De Clercq.
Yeah.
Mac Anaspi, son of the bishop. Mac Taggart, son of the priest. MacPherson, son of the parson. All these names, they survive. Like De Clercq, De Clare, Clark. They've survived in all the languages. So we have to think of these as the medieval parish as a very small community, less than a mile from end to end. So in other words, you can actually ring the bell and get there. And you can get there, be at Mass, and then get back to your work. And they're served because there's no shortage of clergy, because the clergy succeed one another.
I remember that somebody told me in Auckland there was a bishop some years ago, 60 years, or I can't remember, and who had this intention to have a church that you could walk to within the Auckland boundary. And that's why there are quite a few churches. When you are in one parish in Auckland, you can usually reach easily two or three parishes if you have a car. But the intention was, as far as I've been told, the intention was that you could walk to a church.
Well, that would have been the normal experience of most Catholics until 1900.
Hmm.
They walked. The wealthy could either go in a could go in some sort of wheeled vehicle pulled by horses or ride, but the majority of people walked to church.
And in some places in Auckland, they took the boat.
Oh, yeah, well, yes, that's a particular New Zealand variant. But the curious thing at the moment is that because there's such a crisis in the number of professional clergy in the Catholic Church, that they think the idea is you can combine groups and you can scale it up. One priest can do 1,000 people. Why not 2,000? And you build ever bigger churches. Now, there's three problems with that. The first problem is you cannot actually really belong to a group of 3,000 people. The maximum number of people that the average human being can relate to is 150. That's something that has been worked out by management psychologists, mainly following the work of Professor Robin Dunbar. And that is linked to our brain size. And just as there's a size, just as all the different great apes belong to troops, our brain size is linked to a troop of about 150. And that's the largest group of any of the great apes. So if you're in a group that's larger than 150, you will either feel alienated or else you will feel it's not really my group. You've the situation of 1,000 people in one of these big churches. It's only been brought on because there's a shortage of a priest. It's not brought on because people think it's a good idea or because they like it. It's brought on by a bishop who thinks this is the simplest way to cover the map with some sort of, you know, they use phrases like get coverage. It's an idea not derived either from liturgy or theology or from psychology. It's derived from, that's the way soldiers think. And management think. Now, so if you're in this large group of 1,000, you will not have a sense of community. And yet all through the liturgy, people, the priest will be talking about community. We're gathered here. We're a fellowship. We're gathered in the Holy Spirit. Christ is among us. Christ did not say where 1,000 or 2,000 are gathered. He said where 1 or 2 are gathered. So the first thing is, it's you can't have a real human community. The second problem is, you will end up thinking that the liturgy is just a supply chain issue. Mm. If you want to distribute diesel in Auckland, you call in experts. The military will have a plan ready for this. They'll bring in experts and they'll know the exact place to put the tankers to distribute diesel most efficiently. But the liturgy is our work. It's not a consumer product. But it's very interesting, and bishops all around the world are doing this, by the way. They use phrases like, this will allow people to get Mass. This will allow me to use the priest most efficiently to make sure that people have Mass provided for them. No. We're not providing some sort of holy commodity. We're trying to help a community become celebrants of their liturgy. The whole community is to become celebrants of their liturgy, and that whole community is trying to worship. It's not a case that we're not the spiritual McDonald's. And the third problem is this. If our liturgy was primarily a hymn sandwich, Bible study plus prayers, right? Then you can scale that up, because you can even do it over the radio or on the television, because effectively it's just reading and then all the individuals praying in one place. But our liturgy is actually to share a meal. We prepare to share the meal by listening to our memories as we read the scriptures. Then we reinvigorate our memories with preaching. And then as a group, we offer a prayer to the Father asking for needs. But then we eat and drink together. And the whole idea is that we share a loaf. He took a loaf and broke it. And in taking a loaf and breaking it, each person got a piece. And because each had a piece, they were all, as St. Paul says, part of the one loaf. And that loaf is Christ. And then there was a cup, and each was to drink from the cup. Because when you drink from a cup together, you're asserting, we're taking this. Can you drink of the cup of which I must drink? We're saying, I can drink of the cup of the Lord, and we can drink of the cup of the Lord. We're taking on the covenant. This is our covenant. We are asserting it. We are the people of God. Now, the problem is, you can't have a meal that is a meal of sharing a loaf and a cup for a group that's more than 70 or 80 people, because it then just becomes more commodity. You start producing the little wafers, and it's then the fastest problem of dishing them out. So in terms of ecclesiology, which links to our psychology of the social groups, in terms of the nature of what it is that Christians do, and in terms of our own liturgy, this idea that you can scale up from a small group, these are on all three grounds, this is a false path. The real path, of course, is to say, within every group, is the Spirit actually empowering someone. Has the Spirit given the gifts to someone that they're the natural community leader? They can gather people around. Have they given the gift of someone who can draw people in and make them want to share with one another and celebrate with one another? And then the bishop has to ordain that person. And so instead of the bishop changing all the parishes, he should be looking in the community to find the right person to ordain, and then ordain them. Well, why don't we do that? Well, we don't do it at the Catholic Church because, of course, we have a rule about celibacy. All of the church is being turned upside down, and we're going off into something that's psychologically, theologically, and liturgically stupid because bishops decide that celibacy is more important than the life of the church, more important than the life of the community, and more important than the centrality of the Eucharist. So this is the major problem that the Catholic Church has today.
Isn't that beyond the bishops?
Some of the bishops in South America have asked for this, but Pope Francis is still locked into the view that celibacy is a no-go area. And of course, the last pope considered it an absolutely central thing. And even when he retired, he and Cardinal Sarah, though they dispute who wrote what, they published a book that was taken. This is what the old pope thinks. But the problem is, this is often seen just in terms of a thing called the priesthood. It has to be seen not in terms of a special group called the priesthood. It has to be seen as something that is getting in the way of the proper celebration of the entire church. And so it's until people say, well, this is just one issue. It is just one issue, but until this logjam is solved, many of the other logjams in the Catholic Church, which is clericalism, the idea that the church is made up of two tiers, an officer corps and then just the other ranks, and also the idea that really liturgy is what's done by the expert on behalf of the church, an idea derived from Roman liturgy, pagan Roman liturgy. These things can't be tackled, because we can only tackle them when in every 75 people, if you think about it, if the maximum number of people we can deal with is 150, about 75 is the number of people we're actually relating to. And that's only 15, 20 families. You know, it's small, but it's actually a real grouping.
That you know each other and you can trust each other.
Yes, and they're the sort of people you could call on to do something for you.
Yes.
That in that group of 75, well, you need at least two who can preside. Because why
one
must
can
you
get sick.
One is going to get sick, going on holidays. And also, you don't want the dominance of a single voice, because there's a danger in someone who in a group is a single voice who's going to preach week in, week out. They've got people not just need variety. There mustn't be any way that someone can become a spiritual bully. So you need at least two. And probably it would be a very good idea if you had three, an older one, so that you have succession planning, two middle and someone younger. Then you need two or three people who are deacons who can help out in a more specialized way. And then you need some lectors, some catechists, some acolytes. You need a whole... So you actually will the bishop's job then is to try and find in each of these communities the right people who have the natural inclination and skills that grace can then perfect so that it's for the service of the church.
So if you have 75 people with whom you connect very well, it's quite likely that 75 people or at least 60 or 50 people are actively involved. So they would really participate in Mass in a very different way and not, what do you say? Usually you say you participate, you join Mass, but sometimes you hear the term of attending Mass, which sounds very passive.
Well, that is the older model. That was the model of liturgy that the Second Vatican Council sought to eradicate. But, you know, it's not just every... If you have a community of 75 people who are gathering for the Eucharist, you actually need three or four people who will just be responsible to make sure the chairs are properly put out, because they won't be able to afford owning a big special building. They will have to take over a hall or a room somewhere, and someone will have to go there and make sure that in the middle they've got to drag the table into the middle, and then they will have to arrange the chairs, and someone else will have to make sure that it gets opened up. So you end up with all these, each of these are skills that a community will need, and it's to find the right people. For instance, people say, oh, well, what about all the ancient orders? Well, one of the first of the ancient orders was Ostiarius, never heard of now, but it means the guy who keeps the doors, someone who owns the keys. There's bishops, then there's presbyters, then there's deacons, then until 1972, there were subdeacons, then there were cantors. But there was actually a group who had the minor order called Ostiarius, the one who'd open the door and make sure that everything was ready. So it's a case of finding in that group the various skills. And for instance, a very simple skill. If you're going to actually celebrate and sit down and think, you've actually got to take off your coat when you go into the church. Most churches, think about it, the things you take off your coat for and the things you don't take off your coat for. Most people don't take off their coat when they go into church. That means they're not really making themselves comfortable. So you need someone who'll actually take the coats and look after them. Everyone else to be far more comfortable and relaxed and actually sit there and be listening rather than struggling in an overcoat. And in winter time, where you that's the way you go to a football match. In other words, whenever you hear a bishop saying, we're restructuring, he thinks the liturgy is scalable. You can just make it as big as you like. It's psychologically, theologically, and liturgically wrong. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And I just want to say a few words to what is coming up at TT Pounamo, Study and Joy. We have two sessions about Genesis. That's next Monday, the 6th of March. And then on the 20th of March, we have the repeat of last week's session about Genesis. One is with Dr. Christopher Longhurst. That's the coming Monday. And then after that is Brother Karen, who is repeating the session from last week. And for any information, please check out www.studyjoy.nz. Kia kaha, keep safe, and thank you, Tom.
Out there, oh, peace is calling. In the bonds of love we meet. For the world a new day dawning and shining.